listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. We're revisiting an old story that we've covered a couple of times now. It was a story that really hit the news about 18 months ago, so September 2020. You may remember the astronomy world, and arguably the world as a whole, was taken by storm by stories of weird detections in the atmosphere of Venus and the possibility that that could be possible signs of microbial life. We'll come on to a little reminder of that in the course of this episode. But there's been new developments in that process of discovery and trying to figure out what could be going on. To find out more about this story and the developments that are going on, I'm joined by Dr. William Baines, who's a biochemist based at MIT and here at Cardiff University. So, William, welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Let's, first of all, do a bit of astronomy. Let's look at Venus, or planetary science, I guess. Venus is sometimes called the twin of the Earth, or the evil twin of the Earth. It's not a very nice place to, certainly not to walk around the surface, is it?
No, it isn't. And in terms of mass, it's very similar to Earth. It orbits a little bit closer to the sun than we do. But it's got this very dense atmosphere made almost entirely of carbon dioxide. 95% CO2, and this has an enormous super greenhouse effect, which means the surface is over 400 degrees centigrade, completely hostile and inimicable and completely unlike Earth. So yeah, evil twin's a great name for it.
And so much so, the probes, actually, the Soviet probes in the 1970s and 80s that went and landed on the surface, that, I mean, they basically melt, right? It's 450 degrees centigrade or whatever. It's 90 times the atmospheric pressure here on Earth. It's You couldn't imagine any sort of survivability of human life, certainly on the surface, or really any life. But if you go higher up in the atmosphere to about 50 kilometres, it's a slightly different story in some respects, at least. It's a bit more clement.
It is in some ways. The pressure is similar to the pressure at the surface of the Earth. The temperature is similar to the sort of range of temperatures we get on the Earth. So this is the cloud layer, the famous Venus clouds. And at the bottom of the clouds, it gets up to 100 degrees centigrade or more. At the top, it's minus 10, minus 20. But in the middle, it's the sort of range that we could imagine life living in. So from temperature and pressure point of view, yeah, it's like Earth. But from other points, not at all.
I mean, you've said it's 95% CO2 in the atmosphere. So the atmosphere, you'd have to take an oxygen mask if you were to be there. You'd obviously be able to have to fly in some way because you're 50 kilometers above the surface. There are weird and wacky proposals that possibly aren't that weird and wacky for taking gondolas. We've already had robotic balloons in the atmosphere that you could imagine people, on the hot air balloon, basically floating in the atmosphere of Venus. But they would need protection from the atmosphere itself, wouldn't they?
They would, yeah. CO2 itself is, of course, quite poisonous at those concentrations to organisms such as ourselves. For microbes, it's fine. The real problem with the atmosphere is twofold. Firstly, it's incredibly dry. I mean, it's 50 times drier than the driest place on Earth. And any living thing would just be dehydrated to something sort of the composition of Rice Krispies. The other problem is that the clouds themselves were believed to be made of concentrated sulfuric acid. And as well as being a powerful dehydrating agent, so it's an agent that would just dry anything out, sulfuric acid is, of course, an acid, and it would attack any sort of terrestrial biochemicals. So if you've got a terrestrial microorganism, a terrestrial plant, an animal, and put it in those clouds, it would be reduced to a sort of black tar-like material in a matter of minutes to hours.
So not a very nice place, it turns out, for microbes to live in the clouds. At least that was the thinking. We should say that the other factor that is relevant is that above the clouds, then there's an awful lot of ultraviolet and high-energy radiation from the sun, which breaks down a lot of compounds as well. So one of the things that came into a lot of the discussions that have been going on is the fact that a lot of interesting chemical compounds get destroyed by sunlight, essentially, don't they?
They do, yes. Yeah, so you've got this sort of three-layer structure of Venus. So above the clouds, as you say, a lot of hard UV from the sun would be completely hostile to life. in the clouds, you have sulfuric acid, and then below the clouds, you have heat. And all of those environments, very, very dry. So not a great place for life, really.
No, which is why there was a lot of interest 18 months ago, so September 2020, with this discovery of a not very well-known gas, I guess, or a chemical compound called phosphine, which is phosphorus and hydrogen in a chemical compound. A rather unexpected discovery because of many of those conditions on Venus, wasn't it?
Oh, it was completely unexpected. When I first heard of Jane Greaves' initial detection of phosphine on Venus, my jaw just dropped. It was completely unexpected. And it was completely unexpected for two reasons. The first is that phosphine, as you say, is a molecule containing phosphorus and hydrogen. And the atmosphere of Venus has very few compounds that have hydrogen atoms in. So tiny amounts of water, tiny amounts of hydrogen chloride gas, but it's mostly CO2, which is C and O, no hydrogen. So where does the hydrogen come from to make phosphine? No matter what's making it. But the other, and for me, really tantalizing thing was that on Earth, phosphine is only made by life to any significant extent, by microorganisms in some particular environments, and by human industry, but of course, humans are alive. And so there's just this faint nagging suspicion there that perhaps phosphine on Venus was being made by life. And then you go back and look at Venus, and as we've just talked about, it's an incredibly hostile place, which is somewhere you could not imagine life being. So we've got a paradox. We've got something that's only made by life on Earth, but that couldn't be made by life on Venus. So what's going on? And that really sparked the excitement. When you have something like, wow, what's going on? I don't understand that. That's the sign that you're about to make some interesting scientific discovery and forge new ground.
I know there was a lot of care taken over trying to rule out other plausible mechanisms of creating phosphine. So things like volcanoes and lightning and meteorites or meteors going through the atmosphere and all sorts. There was kind of nothing that could do it, as you say, that in those quantities that wasn't biological that you could think of. And to this day, has anyone proposed anything that could explain it in a sort of a secular way, non-biological way?
Not that stood up to it, no. People have suggested, you know, what about this particular chemistry going on in the atmosphere? What about volcanoes? What about volcanoes that originate deep down in the planet rather than on the surface? As you mentioned, lightning, meteorites, rocks rubbing together from earthquakes on the surface, all sorts of things. If you do the calculations in detail to say, could it produce enough phosphine to explain the signal? The answer is always no. So we still have no robust explanation for where this gas is coming from.
Now, the other challenge, as you say, is that the place is very hostile. So if there is life that's creating phosphine, there are microbes in the atmosphere floating in droplets of liquid or something, then there's got to be some weird and wonderful chemistry, at least compared with that we understand about Venus, going on to allow them to survive and thrive. So this is where this latest modelling comes in, these latest models of the chemistry of the Venusian atmosphere that you've produced. And they actually solve a few other problems as well with Venus, because aside from the presence of phosphine, the atmosphere doesn't quite live up to all the models, all the preconceptions that we had about things like the amount of water in either. So there are lots of things that are slightly wrong with Venus's atmosphere, aren't they?
Well, there are. And it's very, and I didn't realize this because I come at this from a chemistry, biochemistry background. And I assume that people knew quite a lot about Venus. I mean, it's very near to Earth. It's got similar sort of overall bulk chemistry to Earth. You think, yeah, people must understand that. Turns out there's some oddities in the atmosphere that nobody's really explained very well. So as you mentioned, there's traces of water above the clouds. Really small amounts, but it's there. All the models suggest there should be none, absolutely none. There's traces of oxygen gas in the atmosphere above the clouds, far, far less than on Earth, but still tiny traces. The models suggest that either should be none or much more than there actually is. There's this weird thing that there's sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere. It's probably produced by volcanoes, as it is on Earth. The amount above the clouds is about a thousandth the amount below the clouds. There's no consistent mechanism explaining why it drops off in that way as you move up through the clouds. And one or two weird results buried in the data from landers, including a couple of results that suggest that the clouds are made of droplets or particles, at least some of which that are not round. And if you imagine the clouds being made of sulfuric acid, it would be liquid. Sulfuric acid is a liquid at those temperatures. And so the droplets would be more or less round. If some of them are not round, they're not spherical, well, that suggests they're not liquid. So that suggests they're not sulfuric acid. So what is going on? And our colleague Paul Rimmer at Cambridge started looking at this and came up with some chemistry that suggests a mechanism for this sulfur dioxide problem particularly. And I had a look at that and we discussed that. So, well, perhaps a particular version of the chemistry he described uses ammonia, which is a gas some of your listeners might be familiar with from household cleaning products, really smelly gas, similar in some ways to phosphine, except it's got a nitrogen and three hydrogens in it. So this gas ammonia was neutralizing the sulfur dioxide in the clouds. So sulfur dioxide was combining with ammonia to form a solid material. And that was the starting point of our recent study.
So you've got the sulfur dioxide combining with ammonia to create, as you say, these weird non-liquid particles that would then float in the cloudlet. So that solves the spherical or the non-spherical droplets conundrum. It solves the where's the sulfur dioxide gone problem. Because it's getting used up in this reaction. How does it solve the water, or does it solve the water and the oxygen, or the presence of water and oxygen problems?
It helps to solve the water problem, because what was the previous model was that sulfur dioxide was combining with water. And so all the water was being taken out of the atmosphere as you moved up through the clouds. Here it's combining with ammonia instead of water. So you leave some water in the atmosphere as you go up through the clouds. The oxygen one is trickier. And this comes back to where the ammonia might come from. So you wouldn't expect ammonia in the atmosphere of Venus any more than you'd expect phosphine. It's got lots of hydrogen in it. It's nitrogen, hydrogen. Where does it come from? In order to make ammonia, you have to take nitrogen gas, for which there's about 3% in Venus's atmosphere. It's about 80% of our atmosphere. You take the nitrogen gas and you split the nitrogen molecule open and you add some hydrogen to it. In order to do that, that hydrogen has to come from somewhere, and that somewhere could be water, it could be sulfuric acid, it could be all sorts of potential sources we looked at. But the end result is some spare oxygen atoms. And if you put those oxygen atoms together, you get O2 gas, and that could be where the O2 gas is coming from. Now, the problem, that's sort of an arm-waving way, that sounds like a solution to the problem. It's not quite, because it doesn't produce enough oxygen gas to explain it. But at least it explains where some oxygen could be coming from.
I'm not a chemist, but could that just mean the reaction is taking place at slightly different rates than we thought to create more oxygen, or is it not quite that simple?
It's not quite that simple, but yes, other things could be going on. I mean, the problem with that is that you take a nice stable compound like water and a nice stable gas like nitrogen, and you split it up into oxygen and ammonia. That takes a load of energy. So that energy must be coming from somewhere. So that is an inherently really improbable thing to happen. So it sort of moves the problem. It's what I've called in other places of displaced improbability. You said, well, we now don't have an improbable way of removing sulfur dioxide and produce oxygen and so on, but we've removed it. We now have a really improbable process that's unexpectedly producing ammonia. Where does that come from? But at least we've reduced the number of problems we've got from three or four down to just one, even though it's still a really big problem.
Yeah. And so then now we have the problem with ammonia. Where does that come from? What's the is there a possible solution to ammonia that helps solve that problem and have any other repercussions?
Well, I'm sort of hesitant to suggest in this because the last time we suggested that a weird gas in Venus's atmosphere could be produced by life, we got some fairly vigorous reaction from the scientific community, shall we say. But one possibility is life. So it's known that, microbial life on Earth turns nitrogen gas into ammonia by exactly this process. It takes spare hydrogens from other sources, adds them onto nitrogen. It's a process that requires a lot of energy, but it's really worth doing because nitrogen is essential for biochemistry.
So it's in DNA and in all the things that are...
In DNA, in protein, in a bunch of stuff, absolutely central. And it would be on Venus if you had life on Venus as well. But additionally on Venus, if life was making ammonia, it would have a huge plus in that those sulfuric acid droplets we mentioned we thought the clouds were made of, if you put ammonia into them, you turn them from sulfuric acid into some sort of salt, ammonium sulfate or something like that, which is not nearly so acid. So the microbes in a little droplet could turn that droplet from being a super acid droplet of almost pure sulfuric acid into something that was nearer to the sort of pH levels, the sort of acidity levels, which we know terrestrial life can survive.
And so rather than being something that's orders of magnitude and billions of times more acidic than anything we know that life can survive on Earth, you just get to something that's very acidic, but still not completely inhospitable. You know, we do find, they're called extremophiles on Earth, right? Things that inhabit extreme environments. And so it's still an extreme environment, I guess, compared with most of the rest of the Earth. But not completely implausible.
Absolutely. We estimate the pH of these little particles would be around 0 or 1. So... And there are microorganisms known that can grow at those sort of pHs. Neutral is 7, and it's a logarithmic scale. So 0 is 10 million times more acid than 7.
So not something you want to drink.
You would not want to drink it. No, yeah. It would. It'd be pretty hideous to drink.
pretty painful experience.
But if you were acidophileness, an acid-loving extremophile, then yeah, you'd be very happy to drink that.
Okay, so we've got this plausible solution where these microbes, these potential microbes, are helping produce ammonia. They're taking the sulfur dioxide, the water, they're producing ammonia. It releases a little bit of oxygen that we might see and makes the place less acidic, so more microbes can live, so the microbes aren't getting destroyed. So it kind of is self-consistent. Is it fair to say it's a self-consistent solution at the moment?
It's self-consistent. There is still one huge problem with it, and that is the shortage of water. So on Earth, all life requires water. If you have no water, you will have no life, without a doubt. Very cold temperatures, high pressures, high acidity, high alkalinity, all these things life can cope with. But if you have no water, you have no life. And this doesn't create water or bring water into the picture anywhere. So this is still a huge problem for suggesting life is there and doing anything at all.
So for that to be then verified in some way, then either there's got to be some weird chemistry or currently unknown chemistry that's allowing water to exist, or I guess maybe some source of water that we haven't identified, or is it possible there's some form of life that doesn't need water in the classic life but not as we know it type idea?
Yeah, well, this gets into the life as not as we know it area, as you say. I mean, we did look into the idea of life that could actually use sulfuric acid instead of water. And it comes up with a sort of maybe, maybe not answer out of that. The chemistry of sulfuric acid turns out to be really interesting. I ended up reading books about it, which my wife regarded as a very odd thing to do. But it's this is really launching out into the area of complete speculation. We really do want to, if we could find a source of water, that would be a much more satisfying answer to the question of what's going on.
It all also rests on there being this ammonia in the atmosphere, and there's no, am I right in thinking there's no evidence at the moment that there is ammonia in the atmosphere of Venus, at least at the quantities required. Is that true?
There's no good evidence. There's a couple of hints. One of the Russian landers had an ammonia detection system in it, which detected a lot of something, but it's not at all clear that what it was really detecting was ammonia. And the Pioneer Venus mass spectrometry data, which Rakesh Mughal has reanalyzed, shows some hint of something that might be ammonia, but it might also be something else.
So a molecule of a similar mass that's...
Yes, yeah. And there are also some nitric oxide products, which are a bit difficult to explain if there isn't something like ammonia being injected into the atmosphere. But it's very tentative. We really need to get good observational data on that.
Okay, so I realize you're not a planetary scientist or an astronomer, or you don't design space probes, but how do we do that?
Well, a space probe to go there will be the best, without a doubt. So you could actually go there and sample stuff. I mean, the real gold standard, brilliant, will be to bring some material back. When you think of how much we've learnt about the moon just from the rocks the Apollo missions brought back, that would be the gold standard. But that's many, many years off. There are some radio telescope observations that you can make from Earth, I'm told by the radio astronomers. And they're having a go at doing that, lining up the telescope time to do that. But yeah, the gold standard will be go there and measure atmospheric constituents and be aware that you're looking for ammonia in the first place, and be sure that you're looking, you've got instruments that can definitely detect ammonia and can definitely discriminate it from anything else you might detect there.
I guess that's the key thing, because it's all very well taking something that can detect all sorts of chemical compounds, but you do need to be able to distinguish between things that might be similar, I guess. There are also, I think three missions now planned to go to Venus in the next sort of decade or thereabouts. So what have we got? We've got Envision, we've got Da Vinci, we've got Veritas. So that's three, one European and two US missions due to go there. Is this something you think that any of those might be able to do? I don't know how familiar you are with the specs of those missions.
I'm not that familiar with the specs of them. I know that the timescale of planning and developing a mission means, of course, that they're fairly far advanced in defining what their instruments are going to be. And if they happen to be suitable for detecting, you know, ammonia or phosphine for that matter, you know, we still need good verification of that by measurements in the atmosphere. If you've got instruments that happen to be suitable for measuring those things, then great. But I'm not sure they do. I think they're really aimed at different sorts of things to be measured. It's designing an instrument that will definitely detect something and be specific when it's operating in an atmosphere that's incredibly dry, very hot lower down, may or may not have sulfuric acid droplets to clog up your instrumentation, has just survived re-entry at, you know, 50 or 100 gravities and the flight from Earth and all that. Designing that is just a spectacularly hard challenge. And I'm in awe that the engineers can get anything to Venus or to Mars or any of these other bodies and have it work at all, never mind get the amazing data they get back. So yeah, quite a challenge for them. It's very easy for me to sit here in my nice comfortable chair and say, yes, you should send a mass spectrometer to Venus. That's easy to say, rather harder to do.
Yes. Well, we hopefully, in the not too distant future, we'll end up with some, as you say, radio data from telescopes on Earth, or some detections from missions that have actually gone to Venus in a few more years after that time. But it is a very interesting speculative problem to try and solve, of whether this whether there could be microbial life on Venus. I suspect it's something that's going to rumble on for quite some time until people find a convincing result either way. I don't know whether you're a gambling man, William. I suspect you've been asked this an awful lot, but do you feel comfortable putting... Do you have a hunch at all, or are you staying agnostic on this?
My gut feel is that it won't be life, I must say. I just think that the barriers, the water barrier, the chemical barriers are just so high that I think we will go there and we'll find some completely weird, unexpected stuff going on in the clouds that happens to produce phosphine and maybe ammonia, or maybe actually it's something completely different and we got that whole story quite wrong. But so that's my gut feel. I think it's less likely than we don't understand the chemistry. But I think the possibility that there just might be life there is something we absolutely have to follow up.
Certainly something I guess you'd kick yourself if you didn't check.
Yeah, absolutely. People have looked for life in very strange and unexpected places. And found it on Earth, all over the place. So they haven't found it where there's no water, no available water, I should say. And they have found something that looked initially like the chemistry life will be doing in places that subsequently there's been no life. So the dry valleys of Antarctica, for example, there's some weird chemistry going on that produces nitrous oxide, which everywhere else is produced is a gas made by life, very characteristically. And there's some strange chemistry going on in these completely dry, life-free valley floors that produce nitrous oxide. So, you know, finding a gas like phosphine or indeed ammonia itself isn't proof. It's just a really good reason to look hard.
Excellent. Well, on that note, a really good reason to look hard. I think it's a good place to end, and hopefully people continue to look really hard at some of this evidence and future evidence. So Dr. William Baines from MIT and Cardiff University, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes at pythagastro.uk, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. And you can find us on Spotify. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.